Hello, listeners. Welcome to the Essentials of Healthy Living on Progressive Talk AM 1260, sponsored by the Village Green Apothecary. I'm Dana Lake, your host for the next hour, reminding you that we're here every Saturday morning at 10 a.m., and we try to cover a wide range of subjects on health, diet, nutrition, lifestyle, and exercise. This show is about you. And the show is also streamed through myvillagegreen.com. That's myvillagegreen.com. Now, during this hour, we're going to cover a few topics in the beginning, like we try to do, what I call news that you can use. We'll talk about B12 protecting against brain shrinkage. That's always good. And do detox foot pads really work? That's kind of an interesting subject, too. Vitorin and cancer risk. In other words, are you at increased risk for cancer using a cholesterol-lowering medication? And arsenic and diabetes, and if we have time, a little bit about psoriasis. So these are just tidbits. The really good part of our show will be when we interview our guest, Kelly Dorfman, who's a nutritionist, a clinician, an author, a lecturer, and it will be very interesting. We're going to talk about intuition in clinical experience. So we'll be happy to have Kelly on with us. Now let's go back to the news that you can use. We talked about B12 before, but there's an interesting subject trying to connect B12 to brain shrinkage. And this was a prospective study. And what that means is that they looked at patients who had no Alzheimer's and no markers for the disease. And this is researchers from England, Norway, and Australia. So it was a pretty large-scale study with 107 men and women who were aged 61 to 87. And remember, they didn't have any cognitive impairment in the beginning of what was a 5-year study. And prospective means you're looking forward. So blood tests to assess B12 status were taken and an MRI scan of the brain, and this was done annually. What they found is that those with the highest levels of vitamin B12 were 6 times less likely to lose brain volume as those with the lowest levels. Now, what we've known in nutrition for a long time is that if you have levels of B12 in the serum that are below 500 or 600, that's considered okay by the typical standards. But what we find when we do more specific studies, like a methylmalonic acid in the urine, that's a test that is elevated when B12 is functionally deficient. So what we find is that most people that are told their B12 levels are good really aren't good. And so this confirms that the higher levels in the serum are connected with not having brain shrinkage. Now, why do people have B12 problems? As you get older, your digestion, absorption declines. And if you're on antacids, you're in trouble because you will deplete or not absorb B12 due to the antacids. And B12 deficiency will increase homocysteine, which is inflammatory and can cause brain shrinkage and dementia. So the connection is really solid here. And recommendations are as low as 100 micrograms, but some people need 1 or 2 milligrams. So it's a broad range. Now, what about those detox foot pads? The companies that sell these foot pads also claim they drain toxins such as heavy metals, metabolic wastes, etc. And when you wear them overnight, there is a smelly substance that accumulates on the pads, and this is supposed to be toxins. Well, I've had so many patients ask me about these that I got some of the foot pads, and I wore them, and then I also put water on them and let them sit out overnight. They looked identical. And what's happening is when your feet sweat a little bit, it's that moisture that combines with the substances that are in the pads to get this result of this dark or brown effect. And it's strong smelling. The pads include ingredients like vinegar and plant extracts. So when they darken when exposed to air and moisture. And so there was no difference in the pads worn and the pads that were sitting out. I'd like to think that it worked, and certainly the skin does detox, and we talk about magnesium Epsom salt baths, magnesium sulfate as being detox baths, and detox is real, but I'm not sure personally that these detox foot pads are really accomplishing anything other than giving you odd-smelling feet. Okay, we have some more information to talk about. Let's talk a little bit about arsenic. There is some connection in the literature with arsenic levels and diabetes, and there's a really good reason for this. There was a study on 788 adults, and they received urine tests for exposure to inorganic arsenic, including synthetic forms, which is a potentially poisonous metallic element found in drinking water. So the result was that participants with the highest total arsenic levels, which was 16.5 micrograms or higher, were 3.6 times more likely to have type 2 diabetes than those with the lowest levels. And there are many theories on this, but I think the most logical explanation is that arsenic, like mercury, is a zinc antagonist. And when zinc is low, you're going to have poor insulin function because zinc is part of the insulin molecule. And we know that people on the white diet, refined grains, carbohydrates, processed foods, they overuse their insulin and they deplete their zinc. So I think it's connected to the depletion of zinc from the intake of arsenic, which would lead to diabetes. But if you're interested in your water being tested for arsenic, consult the EPA's website, www.epa.gov/safewater. And you can also Google it, and I'm sure get to the same site. If you're concerned about your exposure, filter your drinking water with a reverse osmosis filter system and make sure that filter is certified to remove arsenic. Now we have another subject. I said if we had time, we'd get to psoriasis. And psoriasis is a complex condition. There are lots of things you can do with it, and it's certainly not an incurable condition. The first thing you do is get on a healthy diet, and that means getting off the sugar, the caffeine, alcohol, sodas, junk food, all of the things that you hear me talking about on this show. Get back to real foods, what people usually eat. Real fish, poultry, meat, eggs, beans, nuts, seeds. What do we avoid? We avoid milk products and glutens, and we eat more vegetables and also fruits. We go organic, and milk products can increase inflammation and skin problems. We've talked about that before, especially non-organic homogenized milk. But it's easy to test. If you remove the junk, remove the milk products, remove the glutens, and you include a lot of fresh fruits and vegetables. You drink pure water and a lot of it. You don't want to overdo it, but drink between meals and a little bit with meals as well. Then you also supplement wisely with omega-3 fatty acids like EPA and DHA. And you need about 3,000 milligrams to do the job there. There's also a protein isolate that's available. It's a whey protein isolate, and it's tolerated by people who are sensitive to cow milk products. There was a Canadian study published in the Journal of Cutaneous Medicine and Surgery. They found 84 people with mild to moderate psoriasis taking 5 grams of the whey protein for 56 days showed significant improvement. What we find is also important is cleaning the gut, because the gut is the source of a lot of toxins. And how do we clean our guts? We use probiotics. They're extremely important in gut health. And we also get very, very conscientious about elimination. We need fiber. We need to cleanse the gut. We need to drink water. And the nutrients that are very helpful: vitamin A, vitamin D, zinc, vitamin E, and we mentioned the omega-3 fatty acids as being so significant and so important in these conditions. Now, we have just about a minute and a half left. I wanted to cover the Vytorin and cancer risk. And this will be important to many of you who have been on this medication and have concerns. It is a combination anti-cholesterol medication that has a statin drug called Zocor combined with Zetia. And Zetia decreases cholesterol absorption from the food in the small intestine. And this was a 5-year trial developed to determine whether lowering the LDL bad cholesterol with Vytorin reduced the risk for cardiovascular events in people who had aortic stenosis, which is narrowing of the heart valve. Vytorin did not appear to reduce cardiovascular risk, but a larger percentage of people treated with Vytorin were diagnosed with and died from cancer than those who took a placebo. Now, there's a lot of debate about this, but Vytorin, this is not the first study to show that Vytorin not only doesn't improve the situation, Vytorin can increase death rate. And you need to talk to your doctor about it. It was in the 2007 analysis of 16 studies involving statins, and that was published in the Journal of the American College of Cardiology. So why don't you go natural with it? Eat well, eat heartily, remember cholesterol is an antioxidant, and continue to listen to the show. This is Dana Lake wanting you to stay with us. When we come back after the break, we're going to talk with Kelly Dorfman. Hello, welcome back to the Essentials of Healthy Living on Progressive Talk AM 1260. I'm Dana Lake, your host for the hour, and we'll be talking with Kelly Dorfman for the rest of the show. And the subject is very interesting. We're going to talk about intuition and clinical practice. And I want to introduce you to Kelly. She's both a health program planner and nutritionist, and she has about 27 years of clinical experience. And her specialty is developing nutrition and lifestyle strategies to address complex health issues from autism to bone loss to rare genetic disorders. And she's a real problem solver when it comes to patient care. She is a co-founder of DDR, the Developmental Delay Resources. And that's a wonderful organization. I have referenced them many times when we talk about special children and autism. I want to welcome you to the show, Kelly.
Hi, Dana. Thank you.
Well, it's good to have you again. We always have an interesting discussion. I'm just going to let you lead and discuss whatever you want to discuss about our topic or whatever comes to your mind.
Oh, well, thank you. Well, I thought that intuition in clinical practice would be a good subject because so many people have an idea about what may be able to help them, but they don't have the confidence or they get nervous and they don't follow through. And I found that maybe, and I'm sure you have too, Dana, that perhaps 80 or 90% of people sitting in front of you actually know the solution to their own problem. They just don't know how to access it.
Well, don't we hear that when they say, I know what I should do, I just need you to tell me.
Right. Or I always thought it was milk allergy, but somebody said it wasn't, or my mother said I shouldn't, or whatever. And their instincts are there, but they don't really know how to follow through with them.
Well, that's certainly true. Well, expand a little bit more on what intuition is and how we can help our listeners learn how to follow that intuition.
Okay, that's an excellent question. Well, there's different kinds of intuition, so maybe we can start by talking about the different kinds of intuition that people use to function. The kind of intuition that a lot of people use as part of experience, we sometimes been referred to as thin slicing. And what this means is that you can get a big picture from a small piece. And when people are plumbers for a long time or they play tennis for a long time, they seem to, quote, intuitively know what to do next. And some of this is because they have had so much experience in the area that just seeing a small picture or a small idea or a clue can give them a bigger understanding of a problem because of a lot of experience. And a lot of practitioners use this as a way, oh, I've seen when somebody complains about one little thing, they can see a bigger picture because of this thin slicing kind of intuition that is very common when people have a lot of experience. And then there's a kind of a broader kind of intuition, which is, I'll just call this out-of-the-blue intuition. This is just like an idea that seems to come from nowhere. Like perhaps you have a dream, or you just think I should call Grandma, and you haven't thought about it for a long time, and you call, and it turns out that she was sick. This is a little bit harder to understand, and we don't know exactly how to train people to do this, but there is emerging research, believe it or not, that people can be trained in both forms of intuition, just like you can be trained to become a better knitter or a better tennis player.
Well, that's interesting. I know there's always research, but most people, they can't wrap their head around it is what it is. It's hard to define. It's not easy to test. So what kind of research are they doing? How are they doing it?
Well, there's some interesting things. There's one thing that the listeners might find interesting called an IQ2 test, which is a test that was developed to look at what your intuition kind of IQ is. And they ask questions like, are you good at finding Waldo, for example? And different kind of things like this to see, you know, where your personality type is, and, you know, the same kind of test you might do to see if you might be a good gymnast or something else. There are tests now that can look at what kind of skills are necessary, and they're starting to break this down to for people who are naturally better at intuition. But even if you don't have a natural inclination, you can be trained to listen to your intuition, and by using meditative techniques where you can keep quiet so you can listen to that still small voice, or is one way that people sometimes train themselves to listen to intuition more. But probably the most important way is to start following those little nudges and seeing where they lead you, because that strengthens your intuition.
And it validates.
Yes.
It definitely validates, and I know we've talked about this before, Kelly, and working with patients, if all it requires is medical or nutrition knowledge or whatever your knowledge base is, computers could do all the work. The most skilled practitioners are those that have the art of intuition, that the years of experience and looking at patients, listening to them, allows them to come up with answers that a computer wouldn't be able to do.
Absolutely. And the more you trust those answers, the stronger the skill gets.
And trust, I think, is it, because we do drive it out of children when they say, oh, I thought I was here before, and they don't get validated about the experience.
And I think that especially when people have complex medical problems, sometimes all you have is your intuition. You don't have a strong sense of what to do, or there are several paths you can take, and none of them is particularly stronger than another. And so when you get done with the facts, I think intuition is what's left to help you strengthen your health.
Well, it really is interesting, and as you deal with patients, I've often said to the patient, what do you think is the source of the problem? You've thought about it. You've lived, you know, your life. And it's interesting how many of them do have that answer, but they've been told so often it can't be connected.
Right.
That they've learned to ignore it, when in fact that's often the exact road that needs to be looked at.
Yes, and the other thing about intuition is people often mistakenly think that intuition is 100% accurate under all circumstances, and if you're not getting that kind of accuracy, then you shouldn't bother with it. But they did some interesting early studies using something called an ESP deck, which is basically like a card deck with four or five different suits, but instead of spades and clubs, it's like squiggles and squares and so there's four or five cards that come up over and over again, and they would do thousands of trials with people trying to predict which card would come up. And there were certain people that the chances of them getting the right cards, they could do accuracy that was like less than one in a million. But they might only be getting one or two cards more over 100 cards than an average person, just guessing. But when you do it over thousands and thousands of trials, it's highly significant. So even though there may be a lot of ways that you can't guess things right away or you don't have the full picture, I think we have to learn how to deal with intuition with some of the same kind of flexibility that we look at other things.
In other words, it doesn't mean you're 100% right.
Well, it can't be 100% right because intuition is very subjective, and it's very hard to hear things you're not familiar with. So I started an intuition group for doctors and therapists in Montgomery County, and one of the people that came for a while did not have as much medical training as the other people. And he would see things, but he wouldn't have the language for, you know, that's hypothyroidism or, you know, that's multiple sclerosis. And so he had to use the language he had to understand it, which wasn't the language the rest of us had.
Well, I've heard that spoken of with some of the Nobel laureates and the discoveries that they made, that the science knowledge was necessary, but that it was intuition that guided them. Had they not had the language and the knowledge, they couldn't have figured this out. And it involves the Nobel Prize work on the DNA splicing and the determination of the DNA structure. So I found that fascinating, and more than several Nobel Prize laureates admitted to that.
Right, and it's not, people tend to think it's either or, like either you're scientific or you're kind of airy-fairy, but it doesn't have to be that way. You can actually use the best science and combine it with the best intuition to get the highest results.
Well, we're going to continue to talk about this. We'll take a brief break in a minute, Kelly. I do want to learn more about the intuition group and what you all found in that, and give some of our listeners some tidbits on how they can develop their own intuition about themselves.
Okay.
Just reminding the listeners, you are tuned in to The Essentials of Healthy Living, sponsored by Village Green Apothecary. I'm Dana Lake, your host for the hour. We've been talking with Kelly Dorfman. Please stay with us. We'll be back right after this break. Hello, listeners. Welcome back to The Essentials of Healthy Living, sponsored by Village Green Apothecary. I'm Dana Lake, your host for the hour, reminding you to go on myvillagegreen.com. There is a lot of information on diet, nutrition, lifestyle, supplements, and also going green. And I want to remind you about this because it's a tremendous resource. They even have a section called Ask the Expert. So give it a try, www.myvillagegreen.com. And we've been talking to Kelly Dorfman, and Kelly's with us. Welcome back, Kelly.
Thank you.
And we've been talking about intuition in clinical practice, and we were discussing a group that Kelly started, an intuition group for doctors and therapists. Please tell us more about this. I think it's fascinating.
Well, we started a little bit over a year ago, and our objective was to try to put more scientific rigor, if you will, to using intuition in practice, and also to help our clients to use their own intuition to further their health. And we've been doing a number of different kinds of exercises, and we've been actually looking intuitively at clinical cases that are in our practices. If we bring in cases that we're stuck with, or cases where we think there might be an element that we're missing that hasn't been brought out, and then the other members of the group use their intuition to help to see what that might be.
Well, is it a small self-selected group, or is it an open group that others can participate in? And you're keeping it for professionals, correct?
Yes, it is actually a closed group, because part of what happens with a group like this is that you start to trust each other more. You start to sort of build your skills within the group.
Yes.
And the confidence of the group. And so, although I think that there's probably room for an intuition group in every section of Washington, D.C., and I know that for a while there was a practitioner group also in Virginia. But I think it's been very helpful. It sometimes brings up elements that people wouldn't have considered, and because we have a mixture of psychotherapists and physicians, we get a broad range of viewpoints.
Yeah, I would imagine that you do. So what are some of the things that can enhance intuition for any of us?
Well, I think one of the first things to do is, if you want to start accessing your intuition, is to try to figure out what kind of intuitive person you are. And one of the things we discovered in the group is that different kinds of people hear or see things intuitively in different ways. So some of the people in the group actually just hear the information as if they're talking to themselves in their own head. Other people see colors. One person is an artist and tends to see things in pictures. Other people see stories. One of the members, one of the physicians, actually always almost is reminded of a story, almost like a legend or an analogy of some sort. And that's how the intuition comes to him.
Well, that's interesting. And do most of the people that attend this already have some intuitive abilities or aware of it?
Well, to be honest with you, it's been more or less. They've all were interested and all suspected it, but some felt it was out of control or they didn't know what to do with it. If you just start seeing a bunch of colors, that may not have a lot of meaning to you if you're trying to figure out what this person's medical condition is or what direction they should go in. Seeing a red dot, you have to figure out what that means to you. Because it's like learning your own language, or your own intuitive language.
Getting used to it.
Yeah, and what we find is, as we all talk about it, is that we all have different strengths and weaknesses in how we see things. But part of it is, how do you process things? Do you see things? Do you hear things? Do you sense them kinesthetically? And so getting to know your own intuition style is helpful, because just because somebody else sees beautiful pictures doesn't mean that their style is better than yours or works better than yours.
Well, it's not unlike children having different ways of processing and learning.
Exactly.
Auditory, visual, touch, feel. I can see where that makes sense. Do many people have the intuitive feelings come through actual sensations, tingles or heat or different changes in temperature?
That's another style. And that's more of a kinesthetic style.
Mm-hmm.
And some people do experience that. We don't have as many people who are that style in this group, but that is definitely a distinct style. And what will happen is occasionally that style will come up with people who don't normally experience things that way. Like, they'll feel something in their body as a way to pinpoint where the issue is. And interestingly, Holos University, which was started by Dr. Norm Shealy, you may be aware of him, they now have a medical intuitive certificate program, where you can actually train to be a medical intuitive, and their exam takes 5 days, and you have to be 75% accurate.
Wow.
And so this is definitely a skill and a science that can be taught and improved upon. The other thing we found that was useful is, for beginners especially, is to figure out what yes and no feels like, and perhaps start with something that's easier than looking at a broad picture. It was very hard for some of the practitioners in the beginning to just get information raw. And so we found we had to narrow down the field some and help. And we started with feeling what yes and no feels like in your body. So you can go to a quiet place And you can ask your body what yes feels like, or what it feels like when something's right for you. And so, again, there'll be different ways that people can experience this. Some people will feel a swelling in their heart as if their heart is opening up. Some people will feel warm all over. Some people will just hear yes in their head. And then no could be a feeling of disconnect, or you could feel a sinking feeling in your solar plexus.
Well, this is not unlike people will have the experience when they meet someone and have an immediate impression that's either negative or positive, drawn to or repelled.
Exactly. And we've learned that you need to pay attention to those things. But the yes and the no is a really good way to start. And this is actually the basis of muscle testing also, where everything has a vibration. Every thought has a vibration. Every substance has a vibration. And that will either strengthen you or weaken you. And if you can learn what yes and no feels like, you can get a sense about whether something is good for you or not good for you.
Well, that was my next question, was the kinesiology, that isn't that part intuitive, the sensing what's different or abnormal.
Yes, but it's based actually on some pretty interesting, although perhaps abstract, science of quantum physics, which has to do with the fact that everything has an energy imprint that can be measured. And you can make yourself aware of what that imprint is, and you can see whether that print suits you or not. And in muscle testing, the ultimate measure of that is whether your muscles are strengthened or weakened. And they can do that with a large muscle like your arm lifted up and pushed down, or they can do that with a small muscle like your fingers connected together.
Well, it certainly is nice to have it to rely on, especially sometimes you hit the wall with a patient and it just gives you another source of information to guide the practitioner in helping the patient.
Yes, and I think you have to be careful to see it as part of a bigger picture and as part of what you're doing, and you have to really be careful to watch for your prejudices, because intuition is such a small voice that it can be difficult sometimes to get that in perspective. And one of the things we found out from practitioners is that you can be blindsided by it if you're not considering a big enough picture. So one of the cases that I had talked about that was really disturbing, that we had to do with a child that was doing very poorly, and it didn't make any sense. And interestingly, 4 out of the 5 practitioners at the meeting, I'm sorry about that, felt that there was some kind of perhaps sexual abuse history that should be explored. Now, this put me in a really delicate situation because I'm not a psychotherapist, but that certainly would have explained some of the physical problems that I was seeing. So the question is, now, what do you do with that information? How do you act upon it responsibly?
Yes, especially if the individual isn't ready or open to it.
And what if they're just dead wrong? It's just like
yes.
Rude craziness. So you don't really know. But what actually happened instead was that using that information, I spoke to the family again, and they were considering psychotherapy, but they were on the fence about it. But with this information in mind, I felt that I should strongly push them in that direction.
So that they would discover it.
So they could deal with that issue, if it was there, in a better format. And as we were talking about whether psychotherapy was a good idea or not, some things came out that normally wouldn't come out in a nutrition session, for example,
yes,
that suggested that perhaps this intuitive hit by these other practitioners wasn't very far off.
Well, that's fascinating. We're going to take another break, Kelly, and then we'll be right back and finish. Please, listeners, stay with us. We're talking with Kelly Dorfman about the use of intuition in clinical practice. We will be back right after this break. Hi, listeners. Welcome back to the Essentials of Healthy Living, sponsored by Village Green Apothecary. I'm Dana Lake, your host for this day, and we hope you'll join us every Saturday morning at 10 a.m. for the Essentials of Healthy Living. And do remember to go on myvillagegreen.com for all information, health, diet, nutrition, lifestyle, and going green. Well, Kelly, let's continue our talk about intuition and clinical practice. I'm fascinated by the group that you formed that helps practitioners develop their intuition and some of the caveats about it, and also some of the ways that people can develop their own intuition.
We talked so far about looking at what yes and no might feel like, and you can use that to think about foods you're eating or simple things. Would be a good place to start that don't have a lot of emotional charge. Emotionally charged issues are the most difficult things to deal with. And we also talked about the possibility earlier on of getting quiet and finding a quiet spot, because it's very hard to hear your intuition if you're suffering from what the Buddhists call monkey brain, which is yaddy, yaddy, chatter, chatter all day long. We find that meditation or a prayer practice, if that's your preference, is really important in developing intuitive skills.
Well, a lot of people find they have insights about a problem sometimes right as they're falling asleep or waking up or mm-hmm. in the shower or taking a walk, which is just another way of finding some quiet time.
Absolutely.
Or even driving.
Exactly. And people have often said about meditation, they're finally trying to get their brain quiet, and then they remembered that they had forgotten to call somebody or turn the stove off or whatever, because once their brain got quiet, that small voice could pop up and they could actually hear it.
Yeah, that's wonderful. Well, tell us a little bit more about the use in practice and how your practitioners are faring with it in clinical practice. Is it helping them solve a lot of problems?
Well, the more you use it, the better you get at it. And then the better you get at it, the more confidence you have when something comes up that's really strange or different or out in left field. So one of the things that we've been practicing recently, which is really very difficult, is just to try to sense things that there are no clues about. We talked about how thin slicing, you can get a clue, like you could present a case where there's a 26-year-old man that has a heart condition, but that already gives you some clues about which direction you might be going in. It's a lot harder if you have very little information about people. So we've been exploring how to strengthen that. And again, Norm Shealy tells the story, and I went to their conference, if you're interested in intuition, the Nicobom conference, which is the National Institute for Behavioral and Cognitive Medicine. They do a lot of stuff with intuition. They have in Hilton Head in December their annual conference. And he talked about a doctor that he knew who stopped practicing for 2 years and did nothing but read dry charts. If someone would hand him a chart, he would know nothing about it, and he would just practice trying to get information from that chart. And after 2 years, he had over 90% accuracy.
Well, that's fascinating.
So these are things that can be practiced and helped. And that's what we're finding with all of our skills together, is that little by little, those skills are getting stronger.
Well, I think any good medical or nutrition practitioner has to use intuition if they're really going to serve their patient well. And it looks, I think, the allopathic model just doesn't lend itself to it, because the patient has 5 to 10 minutes to get everything stated. And whatever they say first is what is going to be focused on when, as you talk with patients and spend time with them, sometimes it's the last thing they say near the end of a long appointment that is the big clue.
Right.
Don't you think it's going to work best in practices that will spend the time with patients?
Yes, you do need to spend some time with people, and you also have to listen and let people talk for a while. Like you're saying, you can't just ask them to shoot out a bunch of symptoms and be well organized, because people's minds don't operate like that. They can ramble, and sometimes the most important things are also hidden, or they've been told that it's not true. I mean, how many people have you seen that are clearly suffering from allergies or some kind of food sensitivity, and they've been told flat out that that wasn't true?
Oh, absolutely. Actually, I had a patient today who answered the problem as I'm listening to her. She has this inflammation in her mouth with blisters. Mm-hmm. And it's been going on for a long period of time. And, of course, the mouthwash that's used really isn't getting to the source. And she already knew that. And the first time it happened, she was eating salsa. And the next time, she was eating peppers. And then there were some dried tomatoes and tomato soup and V8. And as she's telling me, you know, I'm listening, and she says, "Oh, my gosh, it's tomatoes." And I said, "Well, it could be just tomato, but it could be nightshades." And we had a long discussion about the pro-inflammatory effect, or that she's getting two different kinds of effects from nightshades and then tomatoes as maybe a direct effect from the enzymes in the raw, you know, the raw tomatoes, the salsas. So as she was telling the history, and I know she's told it before, it was very clear to her. So it was not a hard insight to come to a conclusion to.
Right. It's a lot harder, though, when somebody hands you an allergy test that's negative and says, you know, well, we've been told there can't be allergies. Because we tend to listen to tests more than people. And sometimes they just make a very small comment. Like, I saw a man once who had low testosterone, and the doctor kept giving him more and more testosterone, and his testosterone kept on staying the same, and in some cases was actually starting to drop a little bit. And rather than listen to the fact that this wasn't going well, it's because why would that be, that you keep giving testosterone goes down lower? So all of a sudden I'm sitting there, and out of the blue this idea comes to me, maybe it's turning to estrogen and he has breasts. So I asked him, I said, "I have an embarrassing question to ask you. Do you have a problem with breast tissue?" And he turned all red, and he said that he's had this problem all his life. His father took him to the doctor when he was 13, and because of these like breast tissue he had. And it turned out this poor guy was converting every molecule of testosterone his doctor was giving him straight into estrogen and making himself more estrogenic every minute.
And it's interesting that he didn't observe that getting worse.
Well, once it came out, because like I said, once he starts saying something wasn't right, so that gives you the idea, okay, we have to start thinking a different way. So open your mind, you know, what's going on? And I got this image of, you know, estrogen. I'm thinking that's kind of odd. So I thought I'll take a chance. I'll try to ask him a question that we can always just change the subject if it doesn't go anywhere.
Well, and there you go, Kelly. You had to have the knowledge base and the openness and listen.
But otherwise, what was happening in the medical model was they just kept giving him more and more and more.
Right. But that's also not thinking outside of the box. So this would be wonderful education in medical schools. And Kelly, I want to have you back on the show again. I think this is a fabulous subject, and I'm so glad that you introduced our listeners to it. So thank you for being here.
Oh, it's my pleasure, Dana. Thanks for having me.
Okay. Well, listeners, I think that was interesting, and I hope that you've learned a little bit about listening to yourselves and trusting your intuition. It doesn't have to be perfect, but if you have a thought about your own health or you have an insight, take that to your practitioner and open up a discussion of it. I also wanted to tell you a little tidbit on ovarian cancer, which has been very hard to diagnose. And there's a new finding. It was on a lot of patients, 329 women ages 40 to 85. And what they did is have them fill out a questionnaire on ovarian cancer symptoms. And those symptoms are pelvic or abdominal pain, feeling full quickly, and bloating. And they use the blood test CA125, which I've recommended for years. And it's a marker for ovarian cancer. It's not a perfect test, but that combination of the questionnaire and the test identified 80.6% of women with early stage ovarian cancer. And for those of you that know this condition, by the time it's diagnosed, it's usually late stage. And this is terrific, because when you get people in early stage, there's a 70 to 90% chance of recovery. So go on the line and look up ovarian cancer symptoms. I've told you a few of them, and ask about that blood test, CA125. You may save your life or the life of a friend. Well, we're getting to the end of the show, and I just want to remind you again that MyVillageGreen.com is the place to go for nutrition information, for supplements, diet, and ask the expert. You can ask the expert. This is free. Just go on, type your question in, and you'll get some answers. And if you go to MyVillageGreen.com in Bethesda, 5415 West Cedar Lane, you will find lots of experts very willing to help you and guide you through some very easy basic supplementation or if you have complex questions. So remember, www.myvillagegreen.com, and go green with Village Green. So I want to thank you for joining us, and remember to tune in to Progressive Talk AM 1260 every Saturday morning at 10 a.m. for the Essentials of Healthy Living. Remember to take care of yourself and at least one other person, and go green. This is Dana Lake and Village Green wishing each and every one of you good health and a great day.